Good morning, everyone. The Education Finance Division will come to order. Welcome. Kind of good to be here. Hope everybody else feels the same way. I'm Representative Jim Daphne. Have the privilege of chairing this division for the next 2 years. I thought we would start with introductions. I got halfway through mine, or at least a third, my name. I represent District 63A, which is part of South Minneapolis, and I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools. There I've got one child in the schools and one who graduated this spring. And my top priority for the session is working with all of you and teachers and parents and students and administrators across the state to try to strengthen Minnesota's educational opportunities for kids. So if we can start with the minority lead, Representative Kreisha, if you want to, your name, the school districts you represent, and one or two top priorities for you for the session, that'd be great. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and first of all, congratulations, Mr. Chair. I know that you've been involved in education since I've been around in my short tenure, and so it has been near and dear to your heart, so congratulations on the chairmanship. A couple of things for me. My legislative district is 9B. It's Little Falls is my hometown, but I encompass all of Morrison County and then five townships in Todd County. The easiest way to remember is I'm just right in the center of the state. School districts, I think I have 13 that I'm going to try to name them off quickly, but Swanville, Upsala, Royalton, Long Prairie, Little Falls, Piers, I have Staples. I don't have Staples. I have Motley, and I think that's the ones I have. I have a couple other small ones. Top priorities, a couple of things that have melded together for me. I have an education background. I've been in schools for about 15 years before I moved on to other things. But in that time, early education, and really I've also got involved with the child maltreatment area. And noticing that one of the hardest things we do to our children is not let them reach their potential. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's unintentional. But too often, I believe, our youngest kids, just by the fact that the lottery of life put them in a situation, they are at a disadvantage. And it's trying to help those in particular. So that's one of my priorities. And then, of course, looking at equitable funding across the board and what that means. And I know there's lots of different pressure points, push points from different districts. Mr. Chair, what your school districts are facing can be vastly different than what my school districts are facing. And I realize that a lot of times that can be the push and pull of how we look at that with the budget. So there you go. That's me.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Sandra Erickson. I represent District 15A, which is northwest of here. And my primary school districts, although I have a lot of open enrollment, in the Elk River District would be Zimmerman and the Princeton, Malacca. I have students who open enroll to Foley, and part of the Princeton District touches Foley. Mora, Onamia, Ogilvie, Isle. My top priority is if we spend, it should be on the formula.
Thank you very much. Representative DeMuth?
Damuth.
Damuth. Yep. Thank you for correcting me. Congratulations on your election.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Lisa Damuth from District 13A. That's Stearns County, Painesville, Cold Spring, Rockville, Richmond, Avon, St. Joe, Eden Valley, a small portion of Eden Valley, Watkins, and Kimball. So a lot of townships around those. I've got the districts of Ricori, Painesville, Kimball, small portion of St. Cloud, Eden Valley, Watkins, and the Avon, Albany. So a number of smaller districts in my area. I've spent 11 years on the school board, the Ricori School Board. That's my background. And my priorities for this year would be that equalizing the funding across the state.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations. I'm Representative Tony Juergens from District 54B, which is part of Cottage Grove, Hastings, Afton, Denmark Township, and Ninninger Township. The school districts are District 200 in Hastings, South Washington County Schools 833, and a portion of 834 in Stillwater with the Afton kids. In my second term, and also second term on this committee, so it's nice to see some familiar faces and also see some new faces. And my goal for the session with this committee is to help provide students with the tools that they need to succeed as students to become the best that they can be as adults.
I like it. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning. I appear to be the shortest person on this committee. I understand that will be corrected soon, but I'll do it. I can get closer to the mic this way.
it's your background in radio, I'm sure.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I was elected for the first time in 1997 and have been involved with education mm-hmm. here at the legislature ever since. Prior to that, I was on the school board for about 12 and a half years. Also served on early childhood when we had an early childhood committee, and most recently chaired higher education. So education has kind of been something that's been important to me all the years that I've been here. My district is 8A. Fergus Falls is my home. 8A encompasses about two-thirds of Otter Tail County, from Fergus Falls to Perm, if you're familiar with that area. Heavily agriculture, and we get 1,040 lakes, which I tell people and they don't believe me, but we do. So it's heavily involved with agriculture, industry, and tourism. I have a number of school districts. Fergus Falls, in addition to the K-12 public school system, we have Hillcrest Lutheran Academy. They're a private school. We got Pelican Rapids, Battle Lake, Perham. Perham also has an elementary private school, and Underwood. I think that's it. So good school districts. That's the one thing I'm proud of, all of them. And as far as top priority goes, the one thing that concerns me is hearing from teachers who are putting a lot of their own resources into making the school operate. I would like to see somehow the state say, we're going to take care of the priority of the school as a top priority, so teachers do not have to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations on the chair.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Representative Brian Daniels. I'm from the Faribault area, District 24B, which would be Faribault, Morristown, Medford, Nearstrand, Ellendale, Claremont, and last but not least, Hope, because without Hope, we have nothing. For 43 people in Hope, and they are good people. I'm very fortunate. I have the Deaf and Blind Academies in Faribault, and that's what brought us there. My oldest son is deaf, so that's a really strong connection to the school, and basically, you know, that's kind of where my heart is at, Deaf and Blind Academies. We have quite a few charter schools, a Lutheran school, and a CCS Catholic school. Our district is pretty good size. The Faribault district is the largest by far. And what I'm looking for, I guess, for this session's priorities would be the equity in funding, see if we can get a little better on that. I also want to advocate for my deaf and blind academies to get to the tools that they need so they can succeed. And in that is a lot of bills will be coming up on interpreters. We are very shorthanded on interpreters and classification of the interpreters, so that's kind of where my passion will be this year. And I just thanks for the opportunity to serve on the Ed Finance.
Very good. You're welcome. Ms. Parr, we're going to stick with members at this point and then come back and give the staff the spotlight in a few minutes. Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back and good to work with you. Apologize, I have my back to just about everybody here, but I will face the microphone. I'm Peggy Bennett. I am from District 27A. Albert Lea is our biggest community. I've served on this committee for two terms thus far. This will be my third term. I'm a former elementary school teacher. I have degrees in special ed and regular ed both. I taught mostly first grade. But some special ed classes as well. And I have six school districts in my district, the Albert Lea Area Schools, Wells, which is called United South Central, Alden Conger, Glenville Emmons, Blooming Prairie, and Hayfield. And I love kids. I loved teaching. I've been retired for about 4 years, and I miss the kids a lot. So I love it when kids come to the Capitol. And I say my top priorities, one would be in early childhood, reaching more at-risk kids at a younger age, younger than, you know, even the four-year-old age, getting down lower there. And similar to Representative Kreshaw, trying to close that gap that we see with at-risk kids. And the second one would be to start working on closing the gap in the special ed funding. So those are my two.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Chair, and congratulations. And 34 years I taught at Forest Lake High School. And my district is 39A. And first of all, it's good to be back on the committee. I was on the committee for a few years mm-hmm. and then, when I first was elected. And my communities I represent are Schaefer, Franconia Township, Forest Lake, Scandia, Marine, St. Croix, May Township, Stillwater Township, then I have some precincts in Stillwater. School districts that I represent are Forest Lake, Chisago Lakes, and Stillwater. And my priorities this year, again, is equalization in our funding formula. And something I worked on last year that we were able to get some inroads is our transportation varsity. We have 65 school districts in the state of Minnesota that have a deficit in transporting their students from to their schools. So this is something we need to look at and try to help those school districts out with their transportation funding. And because where do they have to take that money out? They have to take it out of their other funds. So we need to make sure as a state that we're helping these schools getting their kids to school and make sure that we have to maybe take a look at the formula, how it's done, and go from there. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Huat. That's gas. caught you, didn't I? Welcome to the committee, sir.
I'm John Hewitt. I'm from Rosemount Apple Valley Coates, which is District 196. I have three boys that went through the, one's still in there, the 14-year-old, but two of them that have graduated from 196. I have an interesting background that I bring to the committee. I've actually worked in EMS most of my life. So naturally I'm concerned when I went into schools and on a call that we'd be dealing with a mental health crisis. So one of my focuses is that, but also on this Friday night I'll be on the floor again. I'm a basketball official, so I get into a lot of your schools around the state and I get to see things that are pretty neat. But also I know that from that experience and what I'm hearing is not every kid comes to school prepared, and I kind of want to see if I can help with that too. So that's what I bring to the committee.
Very good. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Paul Marquardt, represent District 4B, all or parts of Norman, Clay, and Becker counties. And the school districts I represent are Dilworth, Glendon, Felton, where I just finished my 35th year of teaching there, social studies. Norman County West, Ada Borup, Norman County East, Moorhead, Barnesville, Hawley, Euland-Hitterdahl, Detroit Lakes, parts of Lake Park Audubon and Pelican Rapids for school districts. And I agree with almost everything that's been said as priorities. I would just add equalization aid in the operating referendums and bond school debt situation. So, but happy to be on the committee, and congratulations, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sounds like a great conversation for the tax committee, don't you think?
Mr. Chair, I knew you would not want those in your target.
Surprise. Representative Detmer.
Representative Marquardt, you know, I'm his coach.
Ah, the wrestling coach?
Well, I serve on the Minnesota Chapter National Wrestling Hall of Fame, which is located in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And we have nominated, and he's been selected to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
And,
my word. Yes. Yes. Well, fantastic, and congratulations, Representative Marquardt. That's remarkable.
Yes, and thank you, Coach Detmer, and he is a Hall of Fame member right there.
I didn't realize. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Pryor, good morning. We've asked people, as you probably picked up, name school districts and then to name one or two priorities you have for the committee's work this
session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Lori Pryor. I represent Minnetonka and Eden Prairie, and that includes the school districts of Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie. So I think my priorities are much as people have already mentioned, but we're looking at the cross-cut subsidy, and we're looking at mental health in schools and how important those are. And as a grandparent now of two school-aged kids that are in the Minneapolis School District, I care about schools across the state.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having this committee and the introductions. This is my fifth year on this committee, and I was a teacher for 36 years, and it's funny that my first teaching experience was in a county school, St. Louis County School District, up the shore, almost to Two Harbors. It was called Clover Valley. And Clover Valley is in my district now. And the kids that I taught in my first teaching experience are now in Senior Citizens Homesteaders Club with me. But there is one lady, Mrs. Dahlgren, that comes to Homesteaders too, and she's the mom of two of the students that I had. And she always says, "Now I know you. Who are you?" And I say, "I was Jim and Wayne's teacher. I'm Mary Murphy." And she says, "That's right. Oh my, it's so nice to see you young'uns." And so that's my story. And I have, I'm in District 3B now, and I have School District 700, which is Hermantown, and 704, which is Proctor, and 709, which is Duluth, and the surrounding areas, and 381, which is the Lake County, up the shore from the edge of Duluth up the shore to Cook County. And my priorities are the same as they've been for a long time. I will have a bill that I see that there are several other kinds just like it, about the equity for special education funding. And if that doesn't work, at least let's take much lesser amount that 709 got with the last two changes, so that they could be at least what they were before we started adjusting and making it more equitable across the state. Although that won't satisfy their problem, the last two changes that we've made, their amounts of money for special ed has significantly gone down. And my other goal, which is the story of my life, is my support for libraries. Mm-hmm. And it comes from an experience that I had in school, an experience I had in my family. I was the fifth child, and the four other children ahead of me were boys. And they weren't great readers, but they read a lot. But we had about 30 books in our homes, but they were all boy books. And I read them, of course, over and over and over. But I found out there was a library in the school when I was in the third grade. And we had library periods. And we could go to the library once every 2 weeks and get a book. Well, then it got so we could get two books. And so I'd get those two books for those 2 weeks, and I'd read the book, the two books, almost every single night, over and over and over and over, till I had to return them, and then I got two more books. And that lasted all through my grade school experience. And the library wasn't open to me any other time. And that's really terrible. And that's not the story of libraries. And so when I got to high school, I found out you could go to the library after school, and you could read all the books, and you didn't have a limit on how many you could take. And so I became much more of an avid reader at that time. But at the legislature, we still don't treat libraries as the resource they should be in our regions and in our schools. And now, in the last few years, libraries have lost their librarians in many of the school districts. And that's just not right. So volunteers from the community are their librarians or are their media center people. And I just think we need to talk to the Department of Education about the importance of requesting more money for our libraries in the regions and the school districts across the state, because that sum of money has been pretty stagnant for a large number of years. So that's my pitch, and that's what I'm going to keep on.
All right. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Just interesting to note, Representative Detmer, 34 years in the classroom. Representative Marquardt, 35 years in the classroom. Representative Murphy, 36 years in the classroom. And Representative Bennett, how long was it for you?
33.
I like the way it marches out. I'm sorry, I missed that. Representative Kunesh-Podein, 30. Okay. Oh. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Representative Mary Kunesh-Podein. I represent District 41B, which is Columbia Heights and Hilltop, the southern half of New Brighton and St. Anthony Village. So I represent the school districts of New Brighton, St. Anthony, New Brighton, Mounds View, and Columbia Heights. There's lots of private schools and charter schools in there, too. I am a current teacher. I've been teaching now only 24 years, so I'm probably just a newbie. But just Mary, Representative Murphy, created a great segue in for something that I'm really passionate about. I'm a library media specialist. I was in the elementary level for 17 years as a technology educator, literacy supporter, library, testing coordinator, anything that they could throw on my lap, I took. And so I, too, am very passionate about retaining and reinstating the strong library program in elementary schools as well as our communities. So that is one of my priorities, and I actually do have some legislation around that. But I think it's also really important that we are fully funding our schools to the best of our ability. My school district is operating at a $10.6 million deficit, and we felt it the very first day. And it's mostly the human resources that we don't have available to our students. We don't have the health care to attend to some of the mental health issues that we have. We don't have the support for our teachers, so our teachers are working even harder with even less and having to deal with more. And so I look forward to being on this committee and finding really good, positive, sensible solutions to fully funding all the needs. And you've all listed a bajillion of them. They're there. But I really look forward to working with all of you in creating a positive process that goes on from this point on through time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Sandell. I represent 53B, which is most of Woodbury. There are three school districts in my district, A33, South Washington County, A34, Stillwater, and North St. Paul, Maplewood. I taught middle school and high school for 25 years. I am an alumnus of seven Minneapolis public schools, and look forward to being on this committee. My intentions are to pursue and support the ideas of equalized funding and opportunities for children all throughout the state, and forming a strong relationship and partnership among parents, their families, teachers, school boards, administration, and the work that we do with the schools as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
My name is Ruth Richardson, and I represent District 52B, which includes Mendota Heights, Invergrove Heights, Sunfish Lake, and a little bit of Northern Eagan. I agree with much of what's been talked about this morning. I also am very interested in looking at issues related to disability within our schools. I've worked with schools and school districts across the state of Minnesota who are serving students with neurodiverse needs, students with autism, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and hope to have more opportunity to address disparities related to disability and also raise and look at equity issues.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carly Katiza-Watoon. I represent 48B, which is the majority of the city of Eden Prairie and the Eden Prairie Public School District. I am the parent of three little eagles in our early childhood programs, and I serve as a member of the Early Child Advisory Council in Eden Prairie. I'm excited about being a part of this committee, digging into the student-to-counselor ratio here across the state of Minnesota, special ed funding, as well as school safety.
Very good. Thank you very much. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent Hopkins and St. Louis Park and Hopkins and St. Louis Park Schools, so it makes it really easy. I've been a support staff in the schools for quite a few years now, mainly around special ed with our youngest kiddos, and married to a veteran teacher of 27 years. And I would really like us to be focusing on the sped cross subsidy, of course, but then also looking at what districts in our state do things well to close the opportunity gap and how we can support them both financially and see if it's a way, if there's a way we can replicate some of their successes around our schools.
Thank you very much. Representative Edelson.
Good morning, everyone. So Heather Edelson, new representative for Edina. We're known for our schools, and I've been very active in our schools. I'm a mom of three little boys, two of which have special needs. So I have been very active with advocating for students with special needs. So that's something that I'll be thinking about. So I think, Bennett, you had said that, Representative. Also, just yes, cross-subsidy, an increase in funding is definitely something my district's looking at, and I think that's, we share that all in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Vice Chair Sandstead, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, members. I am Julie Sandstead. I represent District 6A, which is a large chunk of northern St. Louis County, as well as a smidgen of Itasca County. I have several school districts in my district and a charter school and private schools as well. My priorities for this session really center on teachers and students. I am a 24-year teacher, or an elementary music specialist currently, but K-12 instrumental vocal music is my background. I really see, and I just left the classroom a couple of weeks ago, I really have seen over the many decades past that we need to be doing more to support our teachers in the classroom, which may look different. It may look like taking things off their plate rather than putting things on their plate. And I think we really need to be mindful of the demands that we are putting on our teachers. As Representative Kunesh-Podein said so eloquently before, today's teachers are having to do so much more with students with really inadequate supports in place oftentimes. So I want to be mindful about supporting teachers in the classroom. I'm also very concerned about supporting our students in and out of the classroom. I think the state of Minnesota is phenomenally fortunate to have the teachers that we do have. We are a very highly qualified state. Our teachers are very well trained for the most part. And I don't feel like it's our teachers that are failing students in the classroom. I feel like our communities, things like that, our dynamics are changing. Our students are coming into the classroom with needs that maybe we didn't see 24 years ago, 25 years ago. So I want to be doing everything we can to support our students in the classroom, but out of the classroom as well. And that's going to include seeing more mental health supports, counselors, nurses, maybe full-service community schools. If you know me, I've been kind of banging that drum for a while. I don't feel like our students are struggling in the classroom or that they don't have the supports there as much as what happens when they leave the classroom. And I think Representative Kreshaw was kind of getting at that, too, in some of the issues that he was talking about. So I'd like to see an elimination of the overabundance of testing that we're doing with our students. I think that it's very important, representing a rural area, that those students are having the same opportunities as other students across the state. So I want to be on top of that. And I really think that the teacher shortage that we've been talking about for so many years is really directly tied to the fact that our teachers are having to do more with inadequate resources. So bringing back just bringing back the profession by doing better for both our teachers and our students.
Thank you, Representative Sandstead. I'd like to shift now to nonpartisan staff, the folks who do the bulk of the work around here and make us look good. Good morning, Mr. Strom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure about that last part for me. I'm Tim Strom. I've had the pleasure of working with the Education Finance Committee since 1987. It's a real joy to be in this committee. It's just my favorite place in the world, and I hope you'll all find it as fun as I do.
Very good. Ms. Ahrens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Emily Adrians. I'm with the Nonpartisan House Fiscal Staff. And this is my third session working with the Ed Finance Committee, so I know a fraction of what Tim knows just yet. But I'm getting there, and welcome to everyone, and I hope it's a good session.
Ms. Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Christina Parra, also in-house research with Mr. Strom. It's my third session here, and my focus is education policy.
Very good. And Laura, good morning, our committee page. I understand this is not your permanent sentence. All right. Thank you for being here today and supporting us. Then, of course, we have committee staff, and I'd like to introduce, well, I'd let Ms. Sunderland introduce herself as the committee legislative assistant.
My name is Brittany Sunderland. I'm the committee legislative assistant here for the Education Finance Division, and I'm also the legislative assistant for newcomer Patty Acom. I am new to the team here, but I am very excited, super grateful for the opportunity to get to work with all of you.
Thank you. Ms. Burt, the committee administrator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sarah Burt, and I'm the committee administrator for this division of Ways and Means, and I look forward to serving you all.
Thank you. And then both caucuses have their own researchers. Mr. Withers, good morning.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jody Withers, researcher for the House Republican Caucus.
Mars Beltrandi Redquist, researcher for the DFL.
Thank you very much. And, oh, is she here? Where? Cassie? Ms. McGinnis? Oh, hi. Sorry. The revisers live on the sixth floor. You don't usually, you know, come all the way down to the ground. If you could just introduce yourself now that we've embarrassed you.
My name is Cassie McGinnis. I am the new revisor for education. I'm currently working with the today's event marks my 1 month anniversary in the office. I came from the State Department, so I was doing federal government stuff that now isn't happening. So I'm
Well, welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. Representative Kreischer, you had some question you wish to raise.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you for the nice job of acknowledging everyone. And to the nonpartisan staff, one of the things I like about you the most is you laugh at our jokes, whether we're in the minority or the majority, so thank you. Mr. Chair, if you'll... understanding the... And I'm sorry, I forgot the name already, the CA...
Ms. Burt?
Ms. Burt, I'll get that. Mentioning this was a division. So for some of us, this is a change. I know this has happened before. And actually, we have a couple of other chairs here. Congratulations, Chair Marquardt, Chair Joachim, and Chair Murphy. I'm just trying to understand, and maybe you know the process, how do you anticipate bills moving? I saw the introduction, and they go to Ways and Means, and now they're referred to a division. How do you see them moving after that? Do you have an do you know? Or do you have ideas? And I don't mean to make this point. I'm really just trying to understand.
So thank you, Representative Kreischer. The process that we're doing now is, as I understand it, both very similar to the way the Senate operates, and if I understood it correctly, very similar to the way the House has operated most of our state's history. More recently, we've had some different structures. So we are a division of Ways and Means. Bills, as you indicated, are introduced, referred to Ways and Means, and then by memo, Chair Carlson moves them to the appropriate divisions. Obviously, in being a finance committee, most of the bills will be heard and held over for possible inclusion in the division report. I think that's the language we're going to use. Although most of the time we'll probably still refer to it as the omnibus bill, right? Those that, for whatever reason, do not, let's say it's a task force that then has to go to government operations or something, we'll move it, I believe, and luckily Ms. Burt probably knows better than I, we'll move it back to Ways and Means by motion, and they will then refer it to government operations. Importantly for members of the public, remember the House rules require that committee agendas, committee hearings, be announced 3 days ahead of time. The Speaker has set a higher standard. She is asking for 1 week notice wherever possible. As we all know, a lot of days you can do that. Ms. Bird has done that for this full week. Some days a week's notice is going to be hard to pull everybody together and work with the authors and work with the community who are going to be coming in to testify. Is that?
Yeah, a couple more.
Please.
Thank you. And that's very helpful. And, again, so you mentioned that there will be a motion to lay on the table for possible inclusion. I understand that. Will we be voting on those, or is that just going to be a recommendation that's going to be a committee report that's going to go up? Do you know yet? Have you worked that out yet?
So, Representative Crescia, so it won't be a motion because, of course, as past practice is, we don't vote on retaining a bill for possible inclusion.
Got it. Okay.
When we get to assembling a final division report, of course, there'll be the markup and the votes at that point.
Okay.
Is that clarifying for you?
A little bit, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So, like, let's say a bill comes up that you're going to move along that maybe you have to go to the tax committee. Will there be a motion to move it out, or does that just become a committee report, and then I sit on Ways and Means along with you and other, will Ways and Means then move that over to tax? And just
Sir Marquardt, can you do you have a understanding since your committee was named?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, taxes is not a division, so we're not kind of working under that. So I presume it probably could be directly referred, but it may have to go through Ways and Means. So I don't know for sure how that would.
Okay. Well, Representative Crescia, we'll all be exploring this.
And I understand. I know it's new. I have to go back to my district, and I have superintendents already asking so we can track bills. So that's really what I'm trying to not go back and be at a disadvantage. Amendments. How do you anticipate amendments? A bill will come up because amendments are normally adopted in the committee, but now this is a division. As I understand it, those amendments will be adopted in Ways and Means. Is that correct? So will it be a committee report with a memo back to Ways and Means where we'll vote in Ways and Means on that amendment? I'm just trying to understand that as well.
So, Representative Crescia, we do have a 24-hour rule on amendments here.
Yep.
With, of course, you know, if some, for some good reason that isn't possible, then at the discretion of the chair, we will be voting. We are in possession of the bill to which the amendment has been proposed. We will be marking up the bill, and we will be voting on the amendments. And then if it is something that has to go to taxes or something that has to go to GovOps and the like, then we'll be moving it along. And, of course, I believe the memos referring bills within divisions are public.
Sure. And I don't think you – I mean, there's no intention to be opaque. I understand that. There's going to be – I'm just trying to understand because I know when you start working with bills, you start working with authors, you're looking for ways to accomplish things, and to know the process is just helpful. So the last thing I'm just curious about then – so what you said, so the bill will be in possession of this division. We could do amendments on that. If we vote on that amendment or those amendments, that will that be recorded in the minutes here? What I just don't understand yet is, as I understand the rules, everything has to be adopted at the Ways and Means level. So I'm not, and maybe I'm just wrong, can we actually adopt it here? Or does it have to be a recommendation that could be just a memo and a committee report that's adopted in Ways and Means? And do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Strom, do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, it's perhaps not my place, and these rules are new and may take some getting used to. But in terms of assembly of amendments to something like the omnibus bill. If those amendments go on a bill that's come here by memo, as I understand it, that bill, as amended, will go back by memo to Ways and Means. If it comes here directly, then it will go back to the floor directory for its next stop. But as I understand it, the process when the Ways and Means sends a memo down that sends the bill down by memo, changes that happen to that bill are included in what's sent back up by memo if the bill is essentially returned to Ways and Means. So if it were a simple bill that needs to go to taxes, maybe a bill dealing with equalization that came from memo, from Ways and Means to this committee made some changes to it, it would then go back to Ways and Means with those changes included, and Ways and Means would be the sending authority to get it over to taxes, not this committee, but the amendments would be on it, just as if the division world didn't exist. So it's my understanding that the bill maintains the form that last amended by this committee when it goes back via memo to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
Representative Krisha, it sounds like learning to ride a bike. You can talk about it and read descriptions and maybe even watch videos of how to ride a bike, but until you get on and start pedaling, you don't really know how to ride a bike.
And so just two more to that.
Yes, sir.
And thank you, and I appreciate that. And in all fairness, I mean, we just all want to know the process. Mm-hmm. And so I understand it's going to be a little bit trying to figure this out as we go. Do you know, and these are questions, by the way, you may not have an answer to that, you could take back, because I think we're still waiting for the rules to be finalized and all that. But two things that I would be wondering about, whether or not we'll have a budget target for this division, or whether Ways and Means will set a budget target with a recommendation for each division, because I think there could be a distinction there. And then the other thing is just, and this is maybe just the open-ended question that you can ask your leadership as they do this, I think it's important to understand whether or not amendments will actually be adopted by the divisions. Because here's a scenario I'm just trying to run through my head. I could see where I could have a bill that has two amendments on it, and I get a recommendation from this committee, but then it gets up to Ways and Means, and Ways and Means decides, we actually adopt these, and I don't know what's going to happen to my amendments. So I'm just trying to play for the uncertainty. So thank you for just – if you have answers to that, fine. But those are things maybe you could just help us by taking to your leadership to say, here's the questions that are on the table. Maybe we can clarify these.
Representative Krisha, glad to do that. My understanding is that this committee is going to have a huge budget target.
I'll leave it at that.
But I may not have heard the speaker quite right. We'll figure that out as time goes on. Most committees start with kind of the boring stuff of overviews and that sort of thing. I wanted to go in a different direction, set the context for our committee's deliberation, which is students, teachers, families, and schools. And so the next several days, as you saw in the meeting notices, we'll be looking at and hearing from the folks who help make our education system work, the folks who deliver the education, and then Thursday, actual students, and having their voices be a part of our deliberations. So we're starting today with an overview from the Minnesota Department of Education. Ms. Snyder? Good morning, Ms. Snyder. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Caitlin Snyder. I'm in government relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. With me today is Stephanie Graff and Kevin McHenry, who will be presenting at the end of our presentation.
Those mics are no,
though. They are.
I need a shorter chair. Sorry about that.
Tomorrow, Representative Nornes's chair.
Again, for the record, Caitlin Snyder from the Department of Education. So today the department was asked to present on school finance trends under the Governor Dayton administration, information about student demographic data and student achievement data. So at the department, we've made 10 commitments to equity. So in front of you, you see those 10 commitments to equity. And I would say that our presentation touches on no fewer than four of those commitments, so prioritizing equity, measuring what matters, following the money, and valuing people. Taking a step back, looking at the past three administrations, what you see in front of you is a table of information of what the trends have been for the basic formula. So for members that are new to the committee, the basic formula is the biggest driver of general education funds. It represents 71% of general education funds. So the first table is, the first column is the increase that's happened in the formula in each year, the dollar amount that that increase represents, and then what that brought the actual formula to. So under Governor Ventura, there was a fairly big shift in school finance. So there was a removal of a statewide levy that supported school funding with the promise that the state would meet that commitment in state aid. So that was a commitment that his administration made, but unfortunately when the recession hit the state, that wasn't something that we could live up to. Under Governor Dayton, he made a commitment that every year of his administration would see new funding into education and was able to provide some increases into the basic formula. One thing to note in fiscal 15 is that there was also a change to the pupil weights. So before that, no student was weighted at 1.0 pupil weighting. That was a change that was made to bring the K-6 pupils into 1.0. So before that, everyone was above 1. Everyone was exceptional. So what that means is that you can't just look between 14 and 15 and say there was a $500 increase. So just something wonky to pay attention to. On the next slide, what you can see is the trend in purchasing power from the basic formula. So this is presented in fiscal 19 dollars adjusted for inflation. So the red line at the top, this is what the purchasing power of the basic formula has been since fiscal 2003. The green line is adjusted for that pupil weighting change. So the red line is showing what that purchasing power for the basic formula has been able to buy for school districts over time. So you can see there's been a decrease in the purchasing power from 2003 through 2019. Because of that, what we've been seeing across districts is an increase in the local levies that property taxpayers approve via voter referendums. So the red line, again, is the purchasing power of the state aid and levy, and then the black dotted line at the bottom is the increase in the levies that we've seen across the state from fiscal 2003 through fiscal 2023. Turning from general education to special education, this graph shows what the total funding has been for special education across the state. So the black dots at the top represents the total from the federal and state aid for special education. You can see the red line on the bottom. There was a one-time increase in federal funding for special education as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. This graph shows what the combination of federal funding for special education and state funding for education, and then the thing to pay attention to is the blue section on the bottom, which is referred to as the cross subsidy. So for members that are new to the committee, this is the amount of funding that the local school districts have to bring to the table when they're educating their students with special needs. This graph shows expenditure data, so what school districts are paying per student in special education as a representation of their total population. So this is the average amount that they're spending as a representation of their total student population. The green dotted line is the amount of state aid they're getting for each student. And then the red line, again, this is the cross-subsidy removing the federal amount. So for fiscal 19, the cross-subsidy is referred to as about $830 or sometimes up to $840 per student. And then no discussion of school finance trends over the Dayton administration would be complete without talking about early education. Over Governor Dayton's administration and with the support of the legislature, there was an increase of $326 million in the state's youngest students, including all-day kindergarten passed in 2013, which we see almost 100% of school districts are participating in now. The creation of early learning scholarships, which have funded 29,500 children and have allowed them to access early learning programs. The creation of voluntary pre-kindergarten and school readiness plus, which this school year funds 7,160 students across Minnesota, including increased funding for Head Start, early childhood, family education, and school readiness as well. Switching into a discussion of student demographics, what you have in front of you is information for the 2017-2018 school year. The school year information for 2018-2019 hasn't been finalized at this point. So all of the students in Minnesota is just over 880,000 students. So this represents any school, any student that's enrolled in a public school. So if you're in an early learning program that's school-based, you're included in this information. Our count of American Indian students is at 1.6% of our student population. You can see our Asian American students, our African American students. One thing that the committee should be aware of as you're moving through these conversations is that these categories are set by the federal government. And one of the requirements of the federal government is that if you identify yourself as white and Hispanic or black and Hispanic, some combination, you're going to be reported as Hispanic under these categories. A similar situation occurs with the two or more races. So if you identify as black and Asian or American Indian and black, you're going to be reported under two or more races. So this is something to keep in mind about any conversation about achievement gap, opportunity gap. The data that we have isn't perfect for how people consider themselves. The other section of student demographic data in front of you is what's referred to as special populations. If you're looking for this data on the MDE website, again, all students in Minnesota is just over 880,000 students. Our English learner population, our dual learner population, is 73,000 students. Students that qualify for free and reduced price meals is about 37% of our total enrollment. Students experiencing homelessness or unstable housing. This is a count that comes from, you might be familiar with the one night count. This is 8,600 students. Again, something to keep in mind is that this is based on the one night count, which is used for a number of county programs. So there are some folks that prefer to use this information. There's also referred to as a rolling count of students that are experiencing homelessness and unstable housing. That's closer to 13,000 students. So again, depending on how you're counting this data, how, which figures you're using, you're talking about two vastly different figures. And then our students in identified for special education services is about 15.7%. That's been fairly steady over the last few years.
Oh, you're good. Ms. Graff, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Graff. I'm the director of the Office of Equity and Opportunity at the Minnesota Department of Education. And we're going to kind of take a little bit of a shift here. Caitlin just talked through a lot of the investments that have been made kind of in recent history and under the Dayton administration, as well as student demographics. And we're going to now kind of pivot. Kevin and I are going to talk through some of the outcomes. It was also requested that we come and talk through achievement data, and we talk through graduation rates and sort of what we're seeing across the state in those areas. Before we kind of pivot to looking at outcomes, I really think it's important to place this in a broader context, and I was really excited to hear a lot of the conversation earlier as you were introducing yourselves and talking about your priorities. I think fits really well with really thinking broadly and comprehensively around the types of data and measures that we use to understand and make decisions for schools and for kids across the state. And as we developed our Every Student Succeeds Act state plan over the course of a couple years with a lot of stakeholders across the state, we heard loud and clear the priority to really look at data in multiple ways around which students have access to certain opportunities, right, around which students are participating in certain opportunities, what that representation looks like, and then really looking at the outcomes. So really considering holistically the student experience. And we have a variety of data that, stakeholders have told us are really, really important to consider when we're thinking at the student experience and we're looking at opportunity gaps. So, you know, just a couple comments here, and it's up on the slide as well. So one thing, it's one thing to offer, right, opportunities for students. So who has access? Which of our students in the state have access to rigorous coursework, to well-rounded education like STEM opportunities, career and technical education opportunities, arts, physical education? And then thinking about participation, who is actually participating and enrolling in those opportunities, and are we seeing proportionate participation? And there's a lot of data that stakeholders have told us are important to look at there. And then representation, and I heard a lot of this earlier as well. What does our staff or our school culture and climate look like? Diversity of staff, right? Does the curriculum represent the students and families and communities that we're serving? And then really thinking about outcomes. So this is a little bit of back mapping. As we think about outcomes, it's important to place it in this context of access, participation, and representation. So we're going to dive into some data on kind of achievement and graduation, maybe starting first with consistent attendance. It's a measure that you may have been hearing over the course of the last year as we put together our Every Student Succeeds Act accountability system, a measure that stakeholders told us is really important. And it's kind of a proxy for student engagement and school climate. It's not the perfect measure, and there are a variety of measures, but it's a proxy, right? So we think about our students regularly attending school, and we think about consistent attendance as kind of the inverse of chronic absenteeism, something that we know research says if students are chronically absent, chronically missing school more than 10% of the days they're enrolled, they are more likely to be off track academically and more likely to drop out. So really focusing in on those students that are consistently missing school, and you can see the data in front of you and the disparities that we have, and thinking about which student groups do we really need to ask the why questions and really think about what are the barriers, right, for those students for regularly attending school. This is one of the measures that we have in our accountability system. It's the school quality or student success indicator in the ESSA accountability system as well. What you're looking at here are our four-year graduation rates. In Minnesota, we use a federally required graduation rate calculation. It's called an adjusted cohort graduation rate calculation, and all states use this standard approach. Essentially, what we do is we look at students over the course of their high school career, and we track whether they graduate on time within 4 years. We also do have extended year graduation rates. We have a five-year, a six-year, and new, we're really excited about, a seven-year graduation rate, which for a variety of reasons, stakeholders made the recommendation to include that in our data reporting and our accountability system, particularly around including students with disabilities that are enrolled in transition programs, entitled to an education until age 21, and then maybe on kind of that seven-year track. So, but what you're looking at here, just the four-year graduation rates, just for the purpose of kind of trying to stay brief for this conversation. You can see some of the increases between 2012 and 2017, and looking at those changes over time. The next slide is just a little bit of a different look longitudinally, really looking at our white student population and our non-white student population, which includes our students of color and our Native American students in the state, and the gap closure over time, around an 8 percentage point closure between 2012 and 2017, again on that four-year on-time graduation rate. And to what extent are students mastering math standards and mastering reading standards? And so that's the next couple tables here. Just to back up for a moment to kind of place this in context a little bit for newer members, we have four achievement levels on our Minnesota comprehensive assessments. We have students that don't meet standards, students that partially meet standards, students that meet standards, and students that exceed standards. So those are sort of the four achievement levels. What you're looking at here are the percentage of students that meet standards or exceed standards. It doesn't include the partially meets or the students that are kind of close to the meeting standards, but it's meets or exceeds, so the percent of students, commonly referred to as the percent of students that are proficient on the mathematics assessment. Students are assessed in the state in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11 in math. What you're actually looking at here is our for consistency purposes, our Every Student Succeeds Act accountability system academic achievement measure, which means the denominator here is all students that were expected to take the test, and the numerator then are those students that meet standards or exceed standards. So students that don't participate in the assessment are actually included in these counts. At a statewide level, that's not going to change the data, but as we look within pockets of the state where participation rates might be lower, we would see some impact on the achievement results as well. But really not a lot of impact on the statewide results you're looking at here. Same context for the reading assessment results. So students in the state are assessed in English language arts in grades 3 through 8 and grade 10. And same here, the denominator here, when you're looking at the percentages, are all students that were expected to take the assessment in spring 2018. And then the numerator are those students that are meeting standards or exceeding standards, which is synonymous with being proficient on the assessment.
All right.
I think I'll shift over to...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner McHenry, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Kevin McHenry. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Continuing on from Ms. Graff's presentation on data, we were asked to present some data of how our students in Minnesota are performing on ACT exams. So just a couple of points before getting into some of the data that I wanted to make sure put a foundation out is just right now all students in our state, districts are required to give the opportunity for students to take the ACT exam or the SAT exam in their schools. So we have a really high percentage of our students, 99% of our students are taking the ACT exam. The ACT does measure English, math, reading, and science, and it also has a writing option as well. And Minnesota ranks among the highest in ACT performance across the nation. And the reason I say among the highest is when you're comparing between states, you're not always comparing apples to apples. Minnesota has, again, a 99% percentage rate. And if you look at states where 80% or above of students are participating or taking the ACT exam, Minnesota does rank first overall, but there are a couple of states that have lower participation that have slightly higher overall ACT scores. What we'll see in our ACT overall ACT scores is that the gaps between student groups still persist. So I think that's one of the important things. We can look at our overall performance, but it's important to look at how all the student groups are performing as well. A couple of pieces of legislation that are important right now, students that meet a specific benchmark determined by Minnesota State, if they go to a Minnesota State institution, they cannot be required to take remedial coursework, so they can enter into specific classes and not be being required to take remedial coursework. Those students are saving money in a Minnesota State institution. And one thing we have seen just with the ACT implementation over the last 5 years is there's been several changes in legislation, and those changes have they've impacted access for students, and they've also impacted participation. So over the last 5 years, we've seen the ACT be part of a graduation requirement for students. We've seen that change to a reimbursement. So not all students were required, but all districts were required to offer the exam. That reimbursement has changed to a reimbursement for students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch while the exam still being offered in schools. And now that reimbursement also applies to the SAT as well. And so while I'm going through the ACT data, I just did want to note that about 3% of our students do participate in and utilize the SAT. And if we look at upcoming classes, the PSAT, we see about 19% of our students that are using that exam as well. In terms of access, with the legislative changes, part of it was it gave the opportunity for students to not have to find different transportation. They would go to the same classroom where they're learning, and they did not have to find a place off-site, so it made it easier for students to participate and take that option of taking a college entrance exam. A couple of notes from ACT is that they have seen an increase of students that take the exam two times or more. So the average score we'll see is at about a 23.7 for students who take the exam more than once. So if students are taking the opportunity of having it in school and they're using their fee waivers appropriately, if they have the opportunity to take it twice, on average they're going to perform better. And then as we've seen across the state that the opportunity for students to use fee waivers, we've seen about 27% of students are not using that opportunity. So there are some opportunities through communication that can help boost the participation of students taking that opportunity. What we have in front of us here is just the ACT graduating class public high school data. A couple pieces of information to see on this chart when you're looking at the overall scores. Obviously, they're broken down between each area, but as well as the overall score, average score students are scoring. What you'll notice is the big jump in participation between 2015 and 2016. That's when the impact of having the ACT as a graduation requirement hit. The exam was offered to all juniors, and so we've seen a delayed effect from that legislation. So this is representing the graduating class. So students that took this the exam in 2015 as juniors would show up in the 2016 data. And so what we've seen is when we've seen the increase in participation, there's been an initial drop. That's something that has been seen throughout the country when states have a significant increase in participation, but then the overall scores are beginning to increase the more that students are anticipating that they have to take one of these exams. And then also, as I noted, it's important to look at how all of our students are doing. So on this slide here, you will see the five-year trends broken down by student groups as well as overall, and that's an area that you can compare to see how all students are performing. One of the things you'll see between student groups is, I talked about access and participation. We're seeing for all student groups the participation increasing. And I know earlier Ms. Snyder referred to, when looking at data, she referred to the two or more counts. We're seeing those numbers increase, but because students are self-identifying when they take the specific exam, they may not identify the same way on their high school enrollment. And one of the options under ACT when students are filling out their information is they do not have to respond. So you can see on the final line that when you're looking at different student demographic data, that number is increasing as well. I just wanted to point that out as you all are digging into data. That you'll see to take that into consideration. So with that, we would wrap up on the ACT piece. Again, the ACT it's not a state administered exam, but we can provide much deeper data if you'd like, and I can have Ms. Snyder or follow up with you, Chair, with the State Minnesota Profile Report if you all really want to dig into that SAT or ACT data.
Right. Ms. Snyder, Ms. Graff, Mr. McHenry, thank you all very much. Are there questions from the committee for any of the testifiers? Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair and ladies and gentlemen, I have a question about the improved graduation rate. What do you think accounts for the improved graduation rates over the last 8 years or so? Well, this, the students meeting the state standards remains relatively low at 60% or less, particularly when we're facing continued limited resources and our scores remain low and the achievement gap remains significant.
Who wants to take that one? Ms. Graff?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative. I can jump in and then would invite Ms. Snyder and Mr. McHenry to weigh in as well. I think it's always challenging to point to I would be lying if I could come up and say there's one reason why our graduation rates have improved over time. Of course, it's a multi-pronged approach, and I think there are a lot of reasons, right, why we've seen the longitudinal data trending up. A couple that come to mind, one is around the time, let's see, these trend lines started in 2012 with the data that we brought to you here. That actually was, I believe, the same year that, or it was the next year, that we lowered our reporting cell, what we refer to as a cell size or an N size in our public reporting, right? So prior to 2012, we had a cell size of 40. And at that point, we were only including about 50% or a little bit lower than 50% of our high schools in the state in a graduation rate calculation. And you can imagine the student groups that were suppressed in that public dialogue around how kids were doing and graduating on time with a cell size of 40, because a lot of schools and districts even, and charters, had fewer than 40 students within those student groups. We lowered that. We now report down to 10. And we've heard consistently from stakeholders the need for transparency by student group as we think about looking at opportunity and achievement gaps, and lowering that cell size really did sort of shed a really bright light on where we're seeing disparities in graduation rates. I think that was one really, really significant change. And just in my experience, and I've been around since 2012 and working with graduation rates, the dialogue and the narrative has changed because of the transparency in that data. We also have had efforts around dropout recovery, credit recovery. Our MIR system is something that really comes to mind, our Minnesota Early Indicator and Response System, really looking at what are the indicators early on in grade 6 and grade 9 that research tells us are predictive of whether students are more likely to drop out or not, and really taking a close look at those indicators and that data and providing strategic intervention to those students that are kind of flagged as at risk, right? And looking at multiple measures. So I think there's a variety of reasons why we've seen this sort of uptick in graduation rates. But you can see disparities persist, and there's still a lot of work to do, right, particularly with our Native students in the state. They're graduating at about 50%. We know that's not good enough, and we know that there's some efforts that need to be done to support those students. I think that, yeah, that's a couple of comments from me. I don't know if Mr. McHenry or Ms. Snyder want to add.
I think that I would echo Ms. Graff's statement. Certainly, this is her area of expertise, so she certainly knows what she's talking about. The one other item that I would add to the conversation is that, again, coming back to the purchasing power of what the school districts have been provided, they're working with their teachers to provide the best available resources to their students, right? But if you've been seeing a school district that needs to make cuts year after year, trying to balance its budget, some of the ancillary pieces that help student achievement, so a curriculum advisor. So if you don't have a curriculum advisor, making sure that you're teaching aligned to the standards, our tests are based on the standards, then you're missing some of the pieces that can help support effective instruction. So making sure that we're providing our teachers the resources that they need to further distill instruction into their classrooms, I think that's an important piece as well.
Representative Sandell, any follow-up?
Thank you. That satisfies me for now. Thank you.
Representative Erickson for our last question for the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Graff, do we have the ability to show the data from consistency in attending school from 12 so we could see that trend line? Or I know because this was part of ESSA, that we created this, but are we able to backtrack so we can see that trend? Because I suspect that attendance has improved.
Ms. Graff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, thank you for the question. We have 3 years, so this is actually, there is a reason why there's a longer trend line in graduation, because we have had more continuity in the way that we calculate graduation over time, where for consistent attendance and even the MCA data, because we're using our new Every Student Succeeds Act accountability system measures and calculations, we provided a snapshot in time because we're just in the middle of rolling out that system, right? So we have 3 years, to answer your question pointedly, of consistent attendance data, and we have 3 years of the academic achievement data as well, but we don't have as long of a longitudinal line using those calculations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. And thank you to the panelists. We wanted to finish today with a glimpse at teacher demographics, the folks who are in the classroom. With us today is Mr. Liuzzi from Pelsby, as we prefer to call it, and I'll let him explain the name and the board as well, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Liuzzi. I'm Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. The long name does lend itself to Pelsby as the acronym. Thank you for being able to come and present to you today. Our goal really was a snapshot of teachers, so what you have as a handout is really just one summary table. Our data analytics team is staffed by zero staff members, so what we do is we pull information from a staff table and then a STAR report. We really get that data as a whole dump of information and then try to figure out how to pull pieces of it together, and it's not always well situated. So if the first sort of message today is this data is messy. You'll notice that the footnotes take up almost as much as the table itself and how we're calculating this information. One thing that we want to emphasize when we talk about a shortage of teachers is the difference between the amount of licensed teachers that we have in the state, those are people that have a license that is not expired, versus active teachers, teachers that actually have an assignment in the classroom. So there's a difference of about 40,000 people that have a license in the state that are not in the classroom. I'm one of those 40,000. I assume that there might be a few people here as well that are in that 40,000 group. We tried to pull out some areas that have been a conversation for shortage areas. The teacher supply and demand report should be coming out in about a week. I assume that I'll be able to come back to committees and talk about that as well. So we don't have the updated information at this moment yet, but we know that these four areas are weigh heavily on shortage conversations. We also wanted to talk about special permissions, and then the special permissions have changed when tiered licensure implementation started in July 1st of 2018. So we also included information about Tier 1 and Tier 2 licenses that have been issued since July 1st in those areas. And so just a few areas to highlight. You can immediately notice that individuals of color and American Indian teachers are much more represented in special permissions, Tier 1 and Tier 2 licenses as well. That speaks to those being a good pathway into education to get individuals of color into the classroom and then move them up tiers into the classroom. Some pieces that you might not, that are difficult to track here. Under active teachers, because we're trying to have an unduplicated count so we know how many individual teachers are there, we have an unduplicated number on the total, but then I think a few members talked about multiple different licenses that they might have. Once we start counting them within different areas, you might have someone who has a special education license and an elementary license. I believe Representative Bennett fits into that category. And then if you teach in one of those areas, you would only be seen as active in that area. So there's some, again, messy data that you'll see there. The early childhood is an interesting one. You might see right away how many licensed teachers and then active licensed teachers. That's really represented because there are very few assignments that require an early childhood license. There might be individuals that are teaching in early childhood, but not in an assignment that requires the early childhood license. In our state, we don't require it in many settings. Additionally, the early childhood license is a birth through grade 3, and traditionally the birth through age 5 assignments are not as well paid as the K through 3 assignments. So that early childhood license, a lot of those individuals are working in an elementary setting where the assignment is elementary. They're working under that assignment, but they're not utilizing the birth through age 5 scope of their early childhood license. What's not included in here are related services. We've pulled those out. We've pulled out some non-instructional licenses as well. But we do know that's considered a shortage area. One of the reasons that it won't really appear to seem a shortage area in our data is because our ability to provide special permissions and related services don't align to the same way that we can provide special permissions outside of related services. Related services have other boards, other statutes that require an individual to hold that certification to be in the classroom. So a shortage area would appear as a district just being unable to hire anyone, not as them hiring someone on a special permission. And we try to collect that data through survey information, so we'll have that as part of the supply and demand report, but it won't appear here, which is why we didn't include it. Now, as a middle school teacher for 6 years of math, I know how having numbers thrown at you can start to glaze over a little bit, so I'd like to save most of the time for questions and also just additional information that you would like us to gather and to bring to you in the future as well to help answer some more specific questions that you'll be facing.
Questions for Mr. Luizzi. Thank you for your presentation. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Luizzi, under teacher preparation enrollment, does PALSBY and previously the Board of Teaching get the data of ethnicity or race or whatever it might be labeled? Do we receive that? I think we used to when I served, but it's not yet collected, so maybe that's promising that we'll learn since we have put a lot of time and effort into teacher shortage and diversity in the last few years.
Absolutely.
And Representative Erickson, thank you for that question. In, I believe it was 2016, it might have been 2015, what we call the data summary report, it's information from teacher preparation programs that we were required to collect. So we started building the system for that. Then in 2017, race and ethnicity was an added category to that. So we collected it, the information, only a portion of the teacher preparation providers were able to provide race and ethnicity data at that time. So we believe next year they will have those systems built, which is why this wasn't collected here. We have faced a lot of concerns. As you can see in just the percentages of teachers of color, when they report that data, they report it by licensure program. And with an N of less than 10, there's concern that they would be sharing personal information, we'd be able to pull that. So we're working with a lot of teacher preparation providers right now to help them aggregate that data up so we can still have sort of a big picture without getting private information from teacher candidates.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any teachers still working under a lifetime teacher's license?
There are. I don't know the. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes. There is one right there. Yes. I don't know the exact number, but it is quite a few thousand, actually. And we do include them in this number.
2,000?
A few thousand. But I'm not sure of the exact number. I can pull that.
Any other questions? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have heard conversations about the number of teachers of color in Minnesota schools being low. And the reason people have told me that is that teachers from other states find it particularly difficult to qualify for a Minnesota teaching license, and therefore will find work opportunities in other states. Is that true, and is that a fair criticism, and is it one of the reasons why our numbers of teachers of color are relatively low?
Mr. Liuzzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. We've actually been digging into that question quite a bit. What I can do is first speak to the out-of-state licensure. Our teacher licensure system was extremely complicated and very difficult. We had when someone came here with preparation from another state, we had a system where we had to analyze their transcript and look course by course to make sure that it was equivalent to preparation in Minnesota. In 2015, the legislature changed that and really opened up pathways. And we looked at last year at the board retreat, we looked at the data. The amount of teachers that we had coming from out of state moved to from around the 1,000 or 1,500 realm to 5,000. So in 2015, that really opened up. the tiered licensure model, I think, will even help more. We had still a few requirements that we were looking at, a human relations requirement, some reading requirements. And the tiered licensure law just has us look at student teaching to make sure that the student teaching that happens in that out-of-state preparation is aligned to Minnesota. So I believe that the barriers that we used to have are no longer for teachers to come here out-of-state. We do have in tiered licensure the requirement that an out-of-state teacher take and pass our content and pedagogy before receiving a Tier 3 license. We've heard anecdotally that that is kind of a new barrier that some folks from out-of-state are facing. What we don't have the data on, and it's just we don't have the systems that even collect it, is to know of those people that are facing those barriers and seeing challenges, how many of those are teachers of color. What we're looking at as a board are really more systemic issues of why individuals of color might not even be going into the field of education versus what are specific barriers. We think both conversations need to happen at the same time.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your time. Members, you may want to look in your packets and check the division rules. Are there nothing surprising, but as we delved into earlier, having some understanding of the rules and the processes is helpful. Representative Kreisha.
Just a thought on that, and
yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, as we have changes, and if you get clarification, and I'm sure you'll probably do this, but I just thought I'd ask if you could just please bring those to us and just allow us to know what as you have new understanding of that, I think that would be helpful.
I'd be glad to do
Thank
that.
Thank you.
With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much. See you in the morning.